I liked watching her smoke. She was beautiful and unreachable. And once again, I held myself back from putting my arm around her and letting my lips touch her cheek, her neck, the back of her ear. Could she tell that wanting to hold her both stirred and dismayed me, because I knew there was no room for me in her world? She had invited me for her father's sake. What made her smoke, though? Watching her hold her cigarette, I couldn't stop from saying, as a French poet once said, some people smoke to put nicotine in their veins, others to put a cloud between them and others. But then, thinking she'd interpret it as a caustic remark, I quickly turned the tables on myself. We all have ways of putting up screens to keep life at bay. I use paper. Do you think I keep life at bay? Hers was a frank and hasty query, not a muffled quip asking for trouble. I don't know. Perhaps going about one's daily life with all its paltry joys and sorrows is the surest way of keeping true life at bay. So there may be no such thing as real life. Only clumsy, ordinary day-to-day stuff? Is this what you think? I did not answer. I just hope there is more than the day-to-day stuff. But I never found it. Maybe because finding it scares me. I did not reply to this either. I never speak to people about this. I don't either, I replied. I wonder why neither of us does. This was the girl on the train speaking, unbending and determined, yet totally adrift. We smiled feebly at each other. Then, sensing that the conversation was taking a strange and awkward turn, he likes desk work too, she threw in and motioned to her father. Her father picked up his cue right away. Great teamwork. I do like desk work. I was a good professor. Then about 8 years ago, I retired. I help writers and young scholars. They give me their dissertations and I edit them. It's lonely work, but it's lovely and peaceful work. And I always learn so much. I spend long hours this way, sometimes from dawn to midnight. Then late at night, I watch television to air out my thoughts a bit. His problem is that he forgets to charge them. Yes, but they love me, and I've grown to love each one. We're always exchanging emails, and frankly, I'm not doing it for the money. Clearly, retorted the daughter. What are you working on now? I asked. It's a very abstract dissertation about time. It starts with the story, or a parable, as he likes to call it, of a young American World War II pilot. He was married to his high school sweetheart in the small town where they grew up. They spent about 2 weeks together in her parents' home before he shipped off. A year and a day later, his plane was shot down over Germany. His young wife received a letter telling her that he was presumed dead. There was no evidence of a crash, nor had his remains been found. Not long afterward, his bride enrolled in a college where she eventually met a war veteran who looked like her husband. They were married and had 5 daughters. She died about a decade ago. A few years after her death, the site of the crash was located and her first husband's dog tag and remains were finally recovered and confirmed through a DNA match with a very distant cousin who had never even heard of the pilot or his wife. Still, the cousin agreed to be tested. The sad part is that by the time the fragments of his body were shipped back to his hometown for proper burial, his wife, both her parents, and the pilot's own parents, and all their siblings, had died. He had no one left, no family to remember, much less to mourn him. His wife herself had never mentioned him to her daughters. It was as though he had never existed. Except that one day, the pilot's wife had taken down an old box of scattered mementos that contained, among other things, the wallet the pilot had left behind. When her daughters asked whose it was, She went to the living room and took down a framed photograph of their father to reveal an old photo tucked right behind it. It was the face of her first husband. They had never known that their mother was married before. She herself never brought it up again. To me, it proves that life and time are not in sync. It's as if time was all wrong, and the wife's life was lived on the wrong bank of the river, or worse yet, on two banks, with neither being the right one. None of us may want to claim to live life in two parallel lanes, but all have many lives, one tucked beneath or right alongside the other. Some lives wait their turn because they haven't been lived at all, while others die before they've lived out their time. And some are waiting to be relived because they haven't been lived enough. Basically, we don't know how to think of time because time doesn't really understand time the way we do, because time couldn't care less what we think of time, because time is just a wobbly, unreliable metaphor for how we think about life. Because ultimately, it isn't time that is wrong for us, or we for time. It may be life itself that is wrong. "Why do you say that?" she asked. "Because there is death. Because death, contrary to what everyone tells you, is not part of life. Death is God's great blunder, and sunset and dawn are how he blushes for shame and asks our forgiveness each and every day. I know a thing or two on the subject." He grew silent. "I love this dissertation," he finally said.
"You've been talking about it for months, Pa. Any idea when we'll be done with it?"
"Well, I think the young man is having a hard time pulling it together, partly because he does not know how to conclude it, which is why he keeps coming up with more examples. This one is about a married couple who fell into a crevasse in an alpine glacier in Switzerland in 1942 and froze to death. Their bodies were recovered 75 years later, along with their shoes, a book, a pocket watch, a backpack, and a bottle. They had 7 children. All but 2 are still alive today. The tragic disappearance of both parents cast a dark, disturbing cloud over their children's lives. Every year on the anniversary of their parents' disappearance, they would climb the glacier and offer a prayer in their memory. Their youngest daughter was 4 years old at the time of the disappearance. DNA testing confirmed her parents' identities and provided some type of closure."
"I hate that word. Closure," said Miranda.
"Maybe because you leave doors open everywhere," snapped the father. He gave her a sidelong, ironic glance meant to say, "You know exactly what I'm referring to." She did not respond. An uncomfortable silence sat between them. I pretended to ignore it. "Another tale in the dissertation," continued her father, "touches on an Italian soldier who, after being married for 12 days, is sent away to the Russian front, where he disappears and is listed as missing. In Russia, however, he doesn't die and is rescued by a woman who bears him a child. Many years later, he returned to Italy to feel as rudderless in a homeland he can't begin to recognize as he does in his adopted Russia, to which he eventually returns for want of a better home. You see, 2 lives, 2 lanes, 2 time zones, with neither being the right one. Then there's the tale of a 40-year-old man who one day finally resolves to visit the tombstone of his father, who died during the war shortly before his son's birth. What strikes the son as he stands speechless before the dates on the tombstone is that his father died scarcely aged 20, half the son's current age, and that therefore the son is old enough to be his father's father. Oddly, he can't decide whether he is saddened because his father never got to see him, or because he himself never got to know his father, or because he is standing before the tombstone of someone who feels more like a dead son than a dead father. Neither of us attempted to lend a moral to this tale.
said the father. I find these tales very moving, but I still can't tell why. Except that I pick up a suggestion that despite appearances, living and time are not aligned and have entirely different itineraries. And Miranda is right. Closure, if it exists at all, is either for the afterlife or for those who stay behind. Ultimately, it is the living who'll close the ledger of my life, not I. We pass along our shadow selves and entrust what we've learned, lived, and known to after people. What else can we give those we've loved after we die than pictures of who we were when we were children and had yet to become the fathers they grew up to know? I want those who outlive me to extend my life, not just remember it. Catching the two of us silent, her father suddenly exclaimed, "Just bring the cake. Right now I want to put a cake between me and what awaits me. Maybe he'll appreciate a cake also, don't you think?" I bought a smaller cake because I knew you'd finish a larger one by the time I left on Sunday. As you can see, she wants me to stay alive. What for, I have no idea.
If not for yourself, then for me, old goon. Besides, don't pretend. I've seen you look at women when we're out walking the dog.
That's true. I still turn around when I see a beautiful pair of legs, but to tell you the truth, I forget why.
We all laughed. I'm sure those visiting nurses will help you remember.
I may not want to remember what I'm missing.
I hear there's medication to remind you.
I watched the mock squabbling between father and daughter. She left the table and went into the kitchen to bring more silverware. "Do you think my health can afford a tiny cup of coffee?" he asked loudly enough for her to hear. "Maybe one for our guest as well?"
"Two hands, Pa, two hands," she pretended to grumble, and moments later brought out the cake and three small dishes, which she left stacked on a stool before going back to the kitchen. We heard her tinker with the coffee maker, then bang the residual grinds from this morning's coffee into the sink.
"Not in the sink," he growled.
"Too late," she responded.
The two of us stared at each other and smiled. I couldn't help myself. She loves you, doesn't she? She does, yes. But she shouldn't. I'm lucky that way. Still, I think it's not good at her age.
Why?
Why? Because I think it's going to be difficult for her. Plus, it doesn't take a genius to see I'm standing in the way.
There was nothing to say to this. We heard her placing the dirty dishes into the sink. "What were the two of you whispering about?" she said when she stepped back onto the terrace with the coffee.
"Nothing," said the father.
"Don't lie." "We were talking about you," I said. "I knew it. He wants grandchildren, right?" she asked.
"I want you to be happy, at least happier, and with someone you love," threw in the father. "And yes, I want grandchildren. It's just the damn clock. Another one of those instances where life and time don't jibe. And don't tell me you don't understand."
She smiled, meaning she did.
"I'm knocking at death's door, you know."
"Did they answer yet?" she asked.
"Not yet, but I heard the old butler shout a drawn-out, 'Coming!' And when I knocked again, he groaned, 'I said I was coming, didn't I?' Before they unbolt the door to let me in, could you at least find someone you love?"
"I keep telling him there is nobody, but he doesn't believe me," she said, turning to me as though I were mediating their discussion.
"How could there be nobody?" he replied, turning to me as well. "There is always someone. Every time I call, there is someone."
"And yet it is always no one. My father doesn't understand," she said, sensing I was more likely going to side with her. "What these men have to offer, I already have. And everything they want, they don't deserve.
or I may not have in me to give. That's the sad part.
Strange, I said.
Why strange?
She was sitting next to me away from her father.
Because I am the exact opposite. I have very little that anyone might want at this point, and as for what I want, I wouldn't even know how to spell it out.
But all this you know already.
For a moment she just looked at me. Maybe I do and maybe I don't. Meaning I'm not playing your game.
She knew just what I was doing long before I knew I was doing it.
Maybe you do and maybe you don't, mimicked her father. You're so good at finding paradoxes, and once you've fished out one from your bag of easy notions, you think you've got your answer. But a paradox is never an answer. It's just a fractured truth. A wisp of meaning without legs. But I am sure our guest did not come to listen to our squabbling. Forgive our father-daughter tiff.
We watched her turn the coffee pot upside down while she covered the spigot with a dish towel to prevent the coffee from spurting. Neither father nor daughter took sugar with coffee, but she suddenly realized that I might want it, and without asking me, rushed to the kitchen to bring the sugar bowl. I did not usually take sugar, but was touched by her gesture and served myself a teaspoon. Then I wondered why I'd done it, when I could so easily have said no. We drank coffee quietly. After coffee, I stood up. Perhaps it's time to head to my hotel to review my notes for my reading this evening. She could not resist. Do you actually need to review your notes? Haven't you given the same reading several times already?
I'm always afraid I'll lose my thread.
I can't picture you losing your thread, Sammy.
If you only knew what goes on in my head.
Oh, tell us, she bandied.
Not without a touch of frisky guile, which surprised me.
I was thinking of coming to your reading today. If I'm invited, that is. Of course you're invited, your father too. Him? She asked. He rarely goes out.
I do go out, her father shot back. How would you know what I do when you're not here?
She did not wait to reply, but went back into the kitchen and returned with a plate on which she had sliced a persimmon in four. The other two persimmons were not quite ripe yet, she said. Then she left the terrace and came back with a bowl of walnuts. Perhaps it was her way of detaining me a while longer. Her father reached for the bowl and picked one. She did too, and found the nutcracker buried underneath the nuts. He did not use the nutcracker. Instead, cracked a walnut with his hand.
I hate when you do that, she said.
What, this? And he cracked another one open as well, removed its shell, then handed me the edible part.
I was mystified.
How did you do that? I asked. Simple, he replied. You don't use your fist, just your index finger, which you place across the seam of both halves, like this, and with the other hand, you give it a firm tap. Voila, he said, offering the contents to his daughter this time. You try, he said, handing me a new nut. And sure enough, I cracked one open just as he had done. You live and learn.
He smiled.
I need to get back to my airplane, pilot, he added, standing up and pushing his chair back into the table and leaving the terrace.
Bathroom, she explained.
She sprang up and went straight to the kitchen. I left my seat and followed her, not quite sure whether I was wanted there. So I stood at the entrance and watched her rinse the dishes one by one, then stack them way too hastily next to the sink before asking me to help her stow them in the dishwasher. She filled the cast iron frying pan with steaming hot water and coarse salt and began to scrub it clean, scraping vigorously as if in a fit of bad temper against a piece of burned fish skin that clung to the side of the pan and wouldn't yield to the metal scrubber. Was she upset? When it came to the crystal wine glasses, though, she was gentler, delicate, as though something about their age and rounded shape pleased and soothed her, and required watchful deference. So she wasn't angry after all. The rinsing took a few minutes. When she was done, I noticed that the palms of her hands and her fingers had turned a very deep pink, verging on purple. She had beautiful hands. She looked at me while drying them with a small kitchen towel hanging from the refrigerator door handle, the same one she had used to stop the coffee maker from sputtering. She didn't say anything. Then she squeezed a dispenser of hand lotion by the sink and rubbed her hands with the cream. "You have nice hands." She didn't respond. All she said after a pause was, "I have nice hands," echoing my words, either to deride them or to question my motive for saying them. "You don't use fingernail polish," I added. "I know." Again, I couldn't tell whether she was apologizing for not using polish or telling me to mind my own business. I had meant to suggest she was different from so many women her age who use all manner of color on their fingernails. But then she probably knew this and didn't need reminding. Lame. Lame talk on my part. She was done in the kitchen. She walked back into the dining room, then headed to the living room to get our jackets. I followed her there, which was when she asked me about my reading tonight. "It's about Photius," I said, "an old Byzantine patriarch who kept a precious catalog of the books he read called the Myriobiblion, meaning 10,000 books. Without his list, we'd never have known the existence of these books because so many of them have completely disappeared." Was I boring her? Perhaps she wasn't even listening to me while she riffled through some of the unopened mail sitting on the coffee table. "So this is what you put between you and life? 10,000 books?" I liked her wry humor, especially coming from someone who, despite her very palpable world weariness on the train, might ultimately prefer cameras, motorbikes, leather jackets, windsurfing, and lean young men who make love at least 3 times a night. "I put so much stuff between me and life, you have no idea," I said. "Then all this is probably over your head." "No, it isn't. I know some of it."
"Oh? Like what?"
"Like, do you really want to know?" she asked. "Of course I want to know." "Like, I don't think you're a very happy man. But then you're a bit like me. Some people may be brokenhearted not because they've been hurt, but because they've never found someone who mattered enough to hurt them." Then on second thought, maybe because she felt she had gone too far. "Call it another one of my paradoxes fished out of my overfilled bag of notions. Heartache can be contracted without symptoms. You may not even know you're suffering from it. It reminds me of what they say about a fetus eating its own twin long before being born. There may never be a trace of the missing twin, but that child will grow up feeling the absence of his sibling his entire life, the absence of love. Except for my father and what you've said about your son, it seems there may have been very little real love or intimacy in both our lives. But then what do I know?" She hesitated for a very short moment, and perhaps fearing I'd start countering or taking too seriously what she'd just said, added, "I sense, though, that part of you may not like being told you're not happy." I attempted a polite nod that also meant, "I'm just going along with what you're saying and won't argue." "But the good part is," she added, then caught herself once again. "The good part is?" I asked. "The good part is I don't think you've closed the book or given up looking. For happiness, I mean. I like this about you." I didn't answer. Perhaps my silence was the answer. "Right," she blurted while handing me my jacket, which I put on, then abruptly changing the subject. "Your collar," she said, indicating my jacket. It was not clear to me what she meant. "Here, let me do it," she said, standing in front of me to straighten my collar. Without giving it another thought, I found myself holding both her hands on the lapels of my jacket against my chest. I had planned nothing of the sort, but simply let myself go and touched her forehead with my palm. I've seldom been this impulsive, and to show I didn't mean to cross a line, began buttoning my jacket. "You don't have to go yet," she suddenly said. "But I should. My notes, my little talk, dead old Photius, the flimsy little screens I put up between me and the real world, they're all waiting, you know." This was special. For me, that is. "This?" I asked, though I couldn't quite bring myself to believe that I knew exactly what she meant. I tried to withdraw, but caressed her forehead one last time, then kissed it. This time I stared at her. She wouldn't look away. And in a gesture that caught me totally by surprise again and seemed to spring from who knows how many years back, I let my fingertip touch her on the chin, softly, the way a grown-up might hold a child's chin between his thumb and forefinger to prevent it from crying, sensing all along, as she did herself, that if she didn't move, this caress on the chin was probably a prelude to what I did next, when I allowed my finger to travel along her lower lip, back and forth. She did not move away, but continued to stare at me. Nor could I tell whether I had offended her by touching her forehead this way, or whether, taken aback, she was still mulling over how to react. And still she continued to stare, bold and unbending. I ended up apologizing. "It's okay," she said, with the start of what appeared to be a suppressed giggle. She was, I was persuaded, overlooking the whole thing and being a grown-up about it. All she did in the end was to turn around sharply and, without saying anything, simply pick up her leather jacket from the sofa. Her gesture was so brusque and so resolute that I was convinced I had upset her. "I'm coming with you to the lecture hall." This baffled me. I was sure that she wanted nothing to do with me after what I'd just done. "Now?" "Of course, now." And perhaps to soften her abrupt turn, she added, "Because if I don't keep an eye on you and follow you around town, I know I'll never see you again." "You don't trust me?" "I'm not sure." Then turning to her father, who was seated in the living room now, "Pa, I'm going to hear his talk." He was surprised and probably disappointed that she was leaving so soon.
"You just got here. Weren't you going to read to me?"
"I'll read tomorrow. Promise." She was in the habit of reading to him from Chateaubriand's memoirs. He used to read Chateaubriand to her when she was in her early teens. Now it was her turn, she said. "Your father isn't very pleased," I said, as we were about to leave. She shut the French windows. The room immediately darkened, and the sudden darkness cast a gloomy air that reflected the nearing end of fall and her father's mood. "He isn't pleased, but it makes no difference. He pretends he's going to work, but he takes such long naps these days. In any event, when he naps, I usually shop around to replenish the fridge with things he likes. I'll do that tomorrow. The nursing service takes care of the rest. His person will come this afternoon and will also walk the dog, cook, watch TV with him, put him to bed." When we had gone downstairs and exited the building and were facing the Lungo Tevere, she suddenly stood still and took a deep, deep breath of fresh late October air. It surprised me. "What was that for?" I asked, obviously referring to what had sounded like a mournful sound emanating from her lungs. "Happens every time I leave. Overwhelming relief. As if I've been choking on bad air inside. One day soon I know I'll miss these visits. I just hope I won't feel guilty or forget why I so badly needed to leave and shut the door behind me. Sometimes I wonder if my son doesn't have the same feeling each time he leaves me. She did not answer. She simply kept walking. What I need is a cup of coffee.
Didn't you just have one? I asked.
That was decaf, she said. I buy decaf coffee for him, which I let him think is regular coffee.
Is he fooled?
Fooled enough. Unless he goes out to get real coffee himself and doesn't tell me. But I doubt it. As I told you, I'm here every weekend. Sometimes when I have a free day, I'll hop on a train and spend the night here and then head back by late morning.
Do you like coming home?
I used to. And then I found myself asking something I'd never have dared ask. Love him? Hard to say these days.
Still, you're an amazing daughter. I've seen it with my own eyes.
She did not reply. A disabused smile that seemed to say, "You don't know the half of it," hovered over her features. I think the love I once had has run its course. What remains is just placebo love, easy to mistake for real love. Aging, sickness, maybe the start of dementia will do this. Taking care of him and worrying for him, calling him all the time when I'm away to make sure he lacks for nothing, all these have worn out everything I had in me to give. You wouldn't call this love. No one would. He wouldn't. Then, as she'd already done before, she cut herself short. Girl needs coffee. Suddenly, she picked up her pace. I know a nice place nearby. As we were headed to her cafe, I asked if she minded making a very short stop across the bridge. I want to take you somewhere. She did not ask why or where, but simply followed. Are you sure you have time? You need to drop your bag, wash your hands, review your notes. Who knows what else? She said with a perceptible snicker in her voice. I have time. Maybe I was exaggerating before.
You don't say. I knew you were a fibber.
We laughed. Then, out of the blue, he is very sick, you know. And the worst is, he knows it, even if he doesn't want to talk about it. I still can't tell whether it's because he's too scared to bring it up or just trying not to scare me. We both allege it's to protect the other, but I think we haven't found a way to talk about it and prefer to postpone confronting it until it may be too late. So we keep it very light and joke about it.
Did you bring the cake?
I brought the cake.
Some more wine for me?
Yes, but only a drop more, Pa. In a short while, he won't be able to breathe. So if the cancer doesn't kill him, pneumonia will.
To say nothing of the morphine he started taking and which eventually causes other problems we don't need to talk about.
I may have to move in with him if none of my siblings will. We all say we'll take turns, but who knows what excuses each will find when the time comes. On our way, we took a slight detour and stopped at my hotel. I said I was going in to drop my bag at the desk. The attendant, who was watching television, said he would have one of the bellhops bring it up to my room. Miranda didn't enter the lobby, but took a peek at the little chapel inside the hotel. When I came out, I saw her using the toe of her boot to fiddle with a loose cobblestone that seemed to interest her. 2 minutes, and you'll see what I meant to show you, I said, sensing her edginess. I wanted to say something about her father, or at least close the subject with a few comforting words. But I couldn't think of a thing that wasn't a platitude, and was glad she had dropped the subject. This better be worth it, she said. It is to me. Within a few minutes, we approached a building on the corner of the street. I stopped in front of it and stood quiet.
Don't tell me. Vigil.
She remembered.
Where?
She asked. Upstairs. Third floor. Large windows. Happy memories? Not especially. I just lived here. And?
If I come back to my hotel each time I'm in Rome, it's because it's just a few steps away from this building, I said, pointing to the windows upstairs that clearly hadn't been cleaned or replaced in decades. I love to hover here. Then it's as if I'm still upstairs, still reading ancient Greek, still grading student papers. I learned to cook in this building. I even learned to sew buttons here, learned to make my own yogurt, my own bread, learned the I Ching. Had my first pet because the old French lady downstairs didn't want her cat any longer and the cat liked me. I envy that young man living upstairs, though he wasn't very happy here. I like to come back later in the evening when it grows dark to watch the apartment. And if a light goes on at my old windows, my heart just bursts.
Why?
Because part of me probably hasn't given up wanting to turn back the clock. Or hasn't quite accepted that I've moved on, if indeed I did move on. Perhaps all I truly want is to reconnect with the person I used to be and lost track of and simply turn my back on once I moved elsewhere. I may never want to be who I was in those days, but I do want to see him again. Just for a minute or so to find out who this person is who hasn't even left the wife he hasn't met yet. And who is still so far from knowing he'll be a father someday. The young man upstairs knows nothing of this, and part of me wants to bring him up to date and let him know I'm still alive, that I haven't changed, and that I'm standing outside here right now. With me, she interrupted. Maybe we can go upstairs and say hello. I'm dying to meet him. I couldn't tell whether she was taking the joke to the next level or being oddly serious. I'm sure he would have loved nothing more than to open the door and see you waiting on the landing, I said.
Would you have let me in? She asked.
You know the answer. She waited for me to add something, perhaps to clarify my meaning, but I didn't.
Not so.
Would you have come in?
I finally asked.
She thought for a second.
No, she replied. Why not? I like the older you better.
A sudden silence fell between us.
Better answer, she asked,
ribbing my arm in a gesture that could easily have meant that even in jest, there was earnest and trusting fellowship between us. I am much older than you, Miranda, I said.
Age is what it is. Cool, she replied.
Almost before I'd finished uttering my sentence. Cool, I smiled. I'd never used the word this way before.
So have you ever stepped inside the building or gone upstairs?
She was changing the subject. Figures, I thought.
No, never. Why not?
I don't know. Did Miss Marguda hurt you that badly? I don't think so. The building has very little to do with her. Other girls came here, though.
Did you like them?
I liked them well enough. I remember one day in particular when I had the flu and had canceled all my classes and lessons. It was one of my happiest days here. I had a fever and no food at home. A girl who was my student heard I was sick and brought me 3 oranges. Stayed a while, ended up making out with me, then left. Short while later, another girl brought me chicken soup. A third dropped by and made hot toddies with so much brandy for the 3 of us that I think I was the happiest man with a fever. One of those 2 ended up living with me for a while. And yet right now, I'm the one standing with you here. Did that occur to you? There was something unusually pinched in her voice, and I couldn't tell why. I thought I was confiding my past the way we'd been doing since riding the train together. Then I gave a light chuckle that I could tell sounded slightly forced.
What's so funny?
It's not funny, it's just that you weren't even born when I used to live here. Neither of us asked why the matter had come up. She took out a small camera from her bag. I'm going to ask these people to take a picture of the 2 of us so you'll know I existed. And wasn't reduced to a fleeting memory like that girl with the 3 oranges, whose first, last, and middle name you can't for the life of you remember now.
Was all this a frenzy of female vanity? She wasn't the type. She stopped a couple of American tourists coming out of the store and, handing one of them her camera, asked the blonde girl to take a picture of us in front of the building. "Not like this," she said. "Put your arm around me and give me your other hand. It won't kill you." She asked the girl to take another picture for good measure. After watching the girl snap a few more times, she thanked her and retrieved her camera. "I'll send you the photos soon enough so you won't forget, Miranda." "Promise?" I promised. "Does Miranda care that much?"
"You still don't understand, do you?
When was the last time you were with a girl my age who's not exactly ugly and who is desperately trying to tell you something that should have been quite obvious by now?"
I had suspected she was about to say something like this. So why did it give me a start and make me hope I'd misread her?
"Say it plainly, Miranda, or say it again."
"Wasn't that plain enough?"
"Then say it again." The words we'd spoken were sufficiently vague for us not to know what the other meant or what we ourselves meant. Yet we both immediately sensed, without knowing why, that we'd seized the other's underlying meaning precisely because it wasn't spoken. Right then, I had a splendid idea. I took out my cell phone and asked if she had anything to do for the next 2 or 3 hours. "I'm free," she replied. "But don't you have things to do? Notes to go over? Clothes to hang up? To say nothing of those hands you needed to wash?" I didn't have time to explain, and right away called a friend who was a well-known archaeologist in Rome. When he picked up, I said, "I need a favor, and I need it today."
"Why, very well, and thank you for asking," he replied with his usual humor. "So, how can I help?"
"I need permission for two to visit Villa Albani." He hesitated a moment.
"Is she beautiful?" he asked.
"Totally."
"I've never been inside Villa Albani," she said. "They never let anyone in."
"You'll see." Then, as I waited for his call back, Cardinal Albani built his villa in the 18th century and amassed a huge collection of Roman statues under the care of Winckelmann, and I want you to see them.
"Why?"
"Well, you fed me fish and walnuts, and you love statues, so I'll show you the most beautiful bas-relief you'll see in your life. It's of Antinous, Emperor Hadrian's lover. Then I'll show you my favorite, a statue of Apollo killing a lizard, attributed to Praxiteles, possibly the greatest sculptor of all time."
"And my cup of coffee?"
"We have plenty of time." My phone rang. Could we be at the villa within the hour? The visit would last no longer than an hour because the custodian needed to leave early.
"It's Friday," explained my friend. We found a cab waiting right off the bridge and in seconds were racing to the villa. In the cab, she turned to me.
"What made you want to do this?"
"My way of showing that I am happy I listened to you."
"Despite your grumbling?"
"Despite my grumbling." She said nothing, looked out for a short moment, then turned back to me.
"You surprise me."
"Why?"
"I didn't expect you to be the kind who jumps on impulse from one thing to the next."
"Why?"
"Because there's something so thoughtful, calming, even-tempered about you."
"You mean dull?"
"Not at all. People trust you and want to open up to you because they like who they are when they're with you. Like right now in this cab."
I reached out, held her hand, then let it go. We arrived in less than 20 minutes. The custodian had been warned of our arrival and was waiting outside the small gate with his arms crossed, almost peremptory and hostile. He eventually recognized me, and his attitude, mistrusting at first, changed to one of guarded respect. We entered the villa itself and headed upstairs and proceeded through a series of chambers until we stood facing the statue of Apollo. It's called Sauroktonos,
Killer of Snakes. We'll walk through the gallery and if there's time, see the Etruscan panels. She stared at it, said she was sure she'd seen a copy of the statue before, but not that one. We rushed through the rest until we got to the Antinous. She couldn't have been more struck by its beauty.
It's amazing.
What did I tell you?
Sono senza parole, she said.
I'm without words right now. Both of us were. She put her arm around me, stared for a while, then rubbed my back once. Then we moved away. A short while later, I turned to her and, pointing to a small bust of a hunchback, whispered in her ear that she could sneak a few pictures with her tiny camera if I managed to distract the guard, as no one was allowed to take photos. I remembered that he'd once opened up to me about his sick mother, so, taking him aside, I asked how his mother had handled her operation. The question was meant to suggest delicatezza, as I was asking it sotto voce, allegedly so Miranda wouldn't hear. He appreciated my discretion and explained that purtroppo era mancata. I gave him my sympathies, and to detain him a while longer and make certain that his back was turned to Miranda, explained that my mother, too, had died.
We are given one only, he said.
We nodded and commiserated.
Back to the Sauroctonos for one last look. I explained that the same statue was in the Louvre and in the Vatican museums, but this and the one in Cleveland were the only ones in bronze.
But this one is not life-size, said the guard. Cleveland's, I am told, is more beautiful.
It is, I said. Then he encouraged us to walk through the Italian garden that led to another gallery filled with statues. At one point in the garden, we turned around to take in the facade and magnificent arcade of the large neoclassical palazzo once deemed the most beautiful of its day.
I think we won't have time to see the Etruscan panels, he added, but in compenso, maybe the signorina might wish to take a few pictures of these statues? Seeing, he added with a mischievous smug smile, she likes taking pictures.
We all smiled at one another. He led us through the garden and to the exit gates, pointing to what he claimed were the 7 oldest pine trees in Rome. As he pressed the button to open the electric gate, an elderly gentleman standing on the sidewalk stared at us and couldn't help saying to the guard,
My family has lived in Rome for 7 generations. Yet never once has any of us been allowed into this villa.
The guard put on his peremptory gaze again and told him it was vietato, forbidden to let anyone in. The gate closed behind us. Before hailing a cab, she said she wanted to take another picture of me by the gate. Why? I asked. No reason. And seeing I looked mopey. Could you kill that frown? She said. But then reacting to my smile. And not a fake Hollywood smile, please. She snapped a few photos. But she wasn't happy. Why did you frown? I didn't know why I had, I said. But I did know.
Yet this morning you're the one who accused me of being glum.
We laughed. She did not seem to expect a comment from me, nor did I push her to explain. But as she kept clicking away, a troubling awareness began to creep up on me. Someday this would be a vigil too, and it would be called Kill the Frown. There was something warm, lambent, and intimate each time she elbowed me this way. She reminded me of someone who storms into your life just as she'd done in her father's living room and right away fluffs your pillows, tears open the windows, straightens 2 old paintings you've stopped seeing, though they've never budged from your mantelpiece for years, and with a deft foot flattens the ripples on the ancient rug,
only to remind you once she's added flowers to a vase that's been standing empty for ever so long that in case you were still struggling to downplay her presence, you wouldn't dare ask for more than a week, a day, an hour of this. How close had I come to someone so real, I thought. How close? Was it too late? Am I too late? Stop thinking, she said. I reached out and held her hand. In the swanky, crowded Café Trilusa that she liked, we found a small, rickety, square table and sat facing each other. Behind her stood one of those outdoor heaters, going full blast. She liked the heat, she said, adding how strange it was that just a few hours earlier it had been warm enough to eat on her father's terrace. Now she wanted something warm to drink. When the waiter came, she ordered 2 double Americanos. What's an Americano, I was going to ask, but caught myself and decided not to. It took me a few moments to realize why I hadn't asked. An Americano is when they add hot water to a cup of espresso. A double Americano is hot water and 2 shots of espresso. She lowered her gaze and looked down at the table, trying to stifle a smile. How could you tell I didn't know what an Americano was? I just knew. I just knew, I repeated. I love this. I think we both did. Is it because your father wouldn't know, so you figured I wouldn't either? Wrong, she said, immediately guessing why I'd asked. That's not why at all, mister. I already told you. Then why? Suddenly the jeering smile vanished from her face. I know you, Sammy. That's why. I look at you now, and it's as if I've known you forever. And here's one more thing, since we're on the subject and I'm the one doing all the talking. Where was she headed with this? I don't want to stop knowing you. So there's the long and the short of it. I looked at her once again, still uncertain what all this added up to. Just don't make me hope, Miranda. Don't. I didn't even want to raise the subject with her because that would be hoping too. The waiter brought us 2 cups. An Americano, she said, adopting the playful tone of moments before, is for people who want an espresso but like American coffee. Or it's for people who just want an espresso that lasts a long time. Go back to what you were saying before, I interrupted. What was I saying? She was teasing. That I've known you forever? Or that I don't want to stop knowing you? The 2 go together. When had all this happened? In the train? In the taxi? In her father's apartment? The kitchen? The living room? Outside Villa Albani, when we spoke of Miss Marguta or passed by my old home? Why did I feel she kept throwing me off course when part of me knew she wasn't doing it at all? She must have known what I felt. It should have been clear from the very start to a child of 6, but in Miranda when? A few whimsical minutes ago, I could so easily wilt no sooner than I'd mistake them for real. And then the thought struck again. Years ago, in a building not 3 blocks from here, I was reading Byzantine scholiasts. Lost in the world of pre-Islamic Constantinople, yet the sperm cell from her pa's gonads that would become Miranda hadn't even been released. I stared at her. She gave a forced, diffident smile that didn't sit with the jaunty, willful, unbending girl who knew all about Americanos. I could have asked her, "What's the matter?" But I resisted. All she did at the end of an uncomfortable pause when neither of us said anything was to shake her head slightly, as though disagreeing with herself and dismissing a silly notion that she knew better than to confide. I'd already seen her do this the moment she sat across from me on the train. Now she looked down at her coffee cup. Her silence unsettled me. We were staring at each other, and yet neither of us was saying anything.
I knew that if I uttered another word, I would break the spell. So we sat there, silent and staring, silent and staring, as if she too did not want to lift the spell.
I wanted to ask, what are you doing in my life? And do people so young and beautiful really exist? Are they even real, outside films and magazines?
And suddenly the ancient Greek verb upsizo raced through my mind. I tried to resist telling her, but then I couldn't help myself. I explained that upsizo meant to arrive too late to the feast, or just before last call, or to feast today with the weight of all the wasted yesteryears. And your point is? Nothing. Exactly. She nudged me, meaning don't go there. And she pointed to a woman who'd been sitting by herself at another table. She keeps staring at you. I didn't believe her, but I liked the idea. Another person was struggling with the crossword puzzle. She's not making good progress, said Miranda. Maybe I should help her with a hint. I finished mine this morning at the station. And by the way, that other one looked at you again. 4 o'clock, to your right. Why is it that I never notice these things? Maybe because you're not a present tense kind of person. This, for instance, is the present tense, she said, reaching over and kissing me on the lips. It was not a full kiss, but it lingered, and she let her tongue touch my lips. And you smell good, she said. Okay, I am 14 now, I thought. Later, while giving my audience a harrowing description of the sack of Constantinople by the Ottomans, I recalled how she'd held my hand as we threaded our way through the narrow streets of Trastevere, as though she were scared to lose me in the crowd when it was I who feared she might any moment be the one to drop my hand and slink away. And I thought of how she burrowed into my arms when I finally held her when we'd stepped outside Café Trilusa, and how she'd placed both fists against my chest, as though struggling against my hug and pushing me away when I realized it was just her way of folding into me before I let myself go and kissed her. I hadn't kissed a woman in so very long, and certainly not with so much passion, and I was about to tell her so when she simply said, keep holding me. Just keep holding me, Sammy, and kiss me. What a woman. And as I was still going on and on about the unimaginable loss of so many works in Phocius' catalog of books, I was saving the best of our duet for last. I know one thing, I told her.
What?
Come stay with me. I have a house by the sea. The thought had just come to me as we were talking, and I had sprung it on her without even thinking. I'd never said anything remotely like this in my life. Her reply was more startling and disarming than what I'd just said. My friends would find this hysterical and think Miranda's lost her mind. I know, but do you want to?
Yes.
Then, in what first appeared to be a second thought on her part, for how long? And this too I'd never said before, but I knew I meant every word. For as long as you want. For as long as you live. We laughed. We laughed because neither of us believed the other was serious. I laughed because I knew I was. And then, without losing my train of thought as I kept addressing the audience about the books that mankind had lost forever, I imagined how she'd look with her face all flushed and with her bare knees parted, how she'd guide me with the same hand I'd held, and that one day soon would taste the brine after swimming in the Tyrrhenian Sea minutes before noon every day. This is what we'll do, she said, once we were heading up Via Garibaldi. I'll sit in the back, somewhere invisible in the audience, and I'll just wait, because I'm sure everyone is going to want to talk to you and ask questions about the reading and your other books, and then we'll sneak off and go for dinner somewhere where they serve good wine.
because I want very good wine tonight. Then after dinner, we'll have a nightcap in a bar I know, and you'll tell me everything you already told me about everyone in your life, and I'll tell you all you wish to know about me. And after that, I'll walk you back to your hotel, or you can walk me back to my dad's, and I might as well tell you now. I'm terrible the first time. I admired her for saying something most people won't even discuss before the fact. Who isn't terrible the first time? How would you know? It made the two of us laugh. Why are you terrible? I asked. It takes me a while to get used to someone. Maybe nerves, though I don't feel nervous with you, which makes me plenty nervous in itself. I don't want to be nervous.
Miranda, I said, as we stopped by the tiny tempietto of San Pietro in Montorio, and I held her as we looked at Bramante's masterpiece.
Is any of this real?
You tell me.
But tell me now. I don't need proof, and neither do you, but I don't want surprises, and I don't want to get hurt.
Cool, I heard myself say. It made the two of us laugh. Then we're good. When we arrived at the hall, we were interrupted by the director who wanted to escort me to a makeshift green room. We separated hastily. She motioned she was going to wait outside after my reading. It happened right after I was putting my pages back into my slim leather folder. I shook hands with my host, then with another professor, and with all the eager specialists, fellows, and students who had come up to the podium afterward. But my behavior was meant to convey haste. One of the older fellows, who sensed I was eager to leave, made a move to escort me away, but then ended up cornering me at the door to ask whether I might read the galleys of his forthcoming book on Alcibiades and the Sicilian expedition. Our topics were closer than they might seem, he said. You have no idea how similar our interests are, he went on. Would I introduce him to my editor? Of course, I said. No sooner was I free of him than I was buttonholed by an elderly lady who said she had read all my books. She had, as I counted the minutes and inches between us, a terrible habit of spitting as she spoke. Finally, I was able to leave the auditorium and reach Miranda where I knew she was waiting, but when I looked, she wasn't there. I hurried downstairs by the main stairwell, but she was not in the lobby either. So I climbed the stairs to the second floor again and walked around the concourse, circling the auditorium. No one. Neither of us had thought of exchanging cell phone numbers. Why on earth hadn't we? I opened the heavy metal door to the auditorium. There were still a few students chatting by the doorway, all clearly about to leave, while two janitors were already picking up empty paper cups and litter in the aisles. Next to the door stood another janitor with a giant keychain, who seemed about to lose his patience as he waited for everyone, including the dean, to clear out so his staff could go about their business. Back on the concourse, and seeing no one was watching, I even opened the door to the women's bathroom and called out her name. No one answered. Had she gone to the bathroom in the basement? The basement was entirely dark. Once I walked out the building, I caught the dark outline of a group of people gathered outside the corner cafe. She was bound to be inside. She wasn't. I wanted to blame the fussy fellow and the foppish old lady spittle-prattling me to death. I had told Miranda that I'd be out within 10 minutes max. Had I totally miscalculated? Or was it my fault because I couldn't say no to people asking for an autograph? I saw the same foreman with the large keyring shuffling out of the building and locking one of the exit doors. I was tempted to ask him if he'd seen a young lady looking for her... Who should I say I was? Her father? Should I check at her father's? And then it finally hit me. Why hadn't I thought of it sooner? She had disappeared. Changed her mind, bolted. no different from how she confessed sloughing off people without so much as a sign or a warning. Pfft. And in her own words, she was out. The whole thing was a fantasy. I'd made it all up. The train, the fish, the lunch, Bramante's Tempietto, the young airplane pilot, the Swiss parents who fell into a crevasse and weren't heard from again until their daughter was older than they'd ever been, the Greeks who'd foreseen the end of Byzantium and fled to Venice and passed on their Greek to generations to come until no one recalled why a few Greek words had crept into their Venetian. All of it unreal. What an idiot! The word sprang to my lips, and I heard it from my own mouth. It made me want to laugh. I repeated the word, idiot. Bit less funny the second time. Still less the third. What were you thinking? I could just hear my son saying this when I saw him tomorrow and told him about the girl on the train called Miranda, who took me to her father's house and made me want things I thought were forever gone from my life. It was quite dark, and I caught myself taking the only path I knew down the Gionicolo and eventually passed by my old building, as if it could reset my bearings and bring me back to earth and remind me who I was. There it stood, sooner than I'd expected, aged and tilting against time, like me, and all my drivel vigils. This, too, made me want to laugh. All those years. And you still haven't learned a thing, have you? Still hoping she'd show up at your door saying, here I am, all yours. Egypt. Of course she had bolted. In 2 years, when they invite me again, I'll pass by this spot and laugh at the person I hope to be. At the life I dreamed of sharing in my house by the beach. Only vigils now. For a moment, I meant to tell her I'm ready to drop everything. I don't care where, when, or for how long you want. I don't care. Here, tonight, I became a minus. I couldn't even feel anger at her or myself. Instead, it was resentment. Resentment not that she had lied or played me or let her fantasies run wild for a moment and stir mine, all the better to dash them, but that she had changed her mind. And who could blame her for that? Resentment because I had given her my trust, and there was no taking trust back. She had crushed it and shot it down the chute without giving my trust or me another thought. I wanted back the me I'd been this morning on the train, and I wanted the whole thing erased. None of it had happened.
Egypt.
Of course it hadn't. After this, I kept thinking, we'll turn off the lights, lock the doors, pull down the blinds, and learn never to hope again. Not in this lifetime. I did not need to cross the bridge. All I did was look up at the last floor of her father's building to see that all the lights were out. Not home. Figures. She knew I'd come and had stayed out on purpose. So I walked back to my hotel. Before entering, I realized that my original plan wasn't so bad after all. Get a bite to eat, catch a movie, have a drink, go to bed, and leave Rome after seeing my son, and then put it behind me. But still, sad how things had turned out. I was about to tell the hotel clerk that I wanted them to wake me up at 7:30 a.m. when I spotted Miranda. She was sitting at one of the many coffee tables along the long corridor beyond the hotel lobby, leafing through a magazine. I thought for a second that you decided to bolt after all, so I waited. I'm never letting you out of my sight again. Instead of speaking, I merely hugged her. I thought, idiot, she said. Then softening her tone, but you found me. I handed the clerk my leather folder and we walked out. You promised me dinner. Dinner it is. Where do you normally go after a reading here? I told her the name. She knew the place. They gave us a quiet corner table, and the wine was plentiful, not the best, but we managed to empty a bottle. Later, we passed my old building again. When I looked up, I saw a light on in the third floor. "Hurts?" she asked.
"No."
"Why not?"
I gave her a "you're fishing" look and smiled.
She took out a large camera and began taking quick shots of the building, of my window where the light was.
"What do you think he's doing upstairs?"
"Oh, I don't know. But what I thought was, the young man upstairs is waiting, still waiting. How would he have known years ago that you weren't born yet? On winter nights when I cooked upstairs and would occasionally look out my kitchen window, I was waiting. But it was always someone else who knocked at my door. In seminars, when I'd light up a cigarette, and in those years you could, I waited for you to open the door. In a crowded movie theater, in bars with friends, everywhere, I waited. But I couldn't find you, and you never came. I kept hoping to run into you at so many parties, and sometimes I almost thought I had. But it was never you. You were 2 years old at the time. And while we're ordering a second round of drinks, your parents are reading you a second bedtime story. And always, as ever, the clock is ticking. In the end, I stopped waiting. Because I stopped believing that you'd stray into my life because I no longer trusted you existed. Everything else happened in my life. Miss Marguda, my marriage, Italy, my son, my career, my books, but you didn't. I stopped waiting and learned to live without you.
What was it that you so desperately wanted in those years?
Someone who knew me inside out, who was me in you, basically.
Let's go inside, she said.
For a moment, I thought she meant for us to go upstairs and had a terrible vision of disturbing the current tenant.
Let's not.
I meant inside the lobby. She did not wait for my reply, but opened the large glass door. I told her that the lobby still smelled as it always had, almost 3 decades later, a blend of cat litter, mold, and rotting wood paneling.
Lobbies never age, didn't you know?
Stand there, she said, taking more pictures of me in the lobby. As she kept backing up to fit me in the frame, I felt drawn closer to her.
You moved.
Miranda, I finally said, nothing like this has ever happened to me. And here is what's so scary.
What this time? I could have missed our train and never known how dead I've been all my life.
You're just scared.
Of what, though?
That tomorrow this could blow away.
It doesn't have to.
And this time, standing in my old lobby whose smell I knew so well, I wanted to tell her how strange it was to be back here and feel that the years in between were simply a no man's land of such small, trivial joys. All of it like rust over my life. I want to scrape off the rust, start here again, and redo the whole thing with you. I did not speak my sentence, but stood there.
What is it? She asked.
I shook my head. Instead, I quoted words by Goethe. Everything in my life was merely prologue until now, merely delay, merely pastime. Merely waste of time until I came to know you. She lowered her camera as I kept drawing closer. She knew I was going to kiss her, so she slammed her back to the wall.
Kiss me, just kiss me.
I cupped her cheeks in both hands and brought my lips to hers, kissed her gently on the lips. Then, with all the passion and desire I'd been trying to suppress since lunch, since watching her rinse the dishes, since she leaned over while talking to the fish vendor and made me want to kiss her face, her neck, her shoulders.